And my wife jabs me in the ribs, and I go, look at her, and I go, what'd you do that for? She said, you spent 10 minutes talking to Alice Cooper, and all you could talk about was a bunch of old cartoons.
That's great. That's
so as far as I know, that's the only Alice Cooper Star Wars connection that I've got. This is Alan Dean Foster, and this is Star Wars Ties.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a special edition of Star Wars Ties. We are really excited today. Mr. Rob Vader on my right and Mr. Lando Fett on my left. We're going to be interviewing the amazing and fascinating author and writer, Mr. Alan Dean Foster.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've already talked to the guy, and without spoiling anything, guys, this is going to be a treat. I think you guys are really, really, really going to enjoy how honest he was. I was really, really impressed with that. Well, I was impressed the whole time. What am I talking about?
Yeah. You're easy to impress, Rob, but no, it was real. To quote Luke Skywalker, this is not going to go the way you think.
No, it is certainly not, but I have had an absolute blast. And guys, I can't wait for you to listen to it. I just didn't know how long it was going to be. We never had really a timeline or anything like that. I don't know what to say. It was awesome.
I'm geeking out. That was just, it was so much fun. You guys are going to really enjoy it.
You are. And he's kind of like Indiana Jones to me. He's like Indiana Jones with all of his adventures that, you know, he does talk about later on in the interview and the Star Wars novels. I mean, he's a very interesting man and the most interesting man that we've ever talked to on this show.
I'll tell you what, you know, we said you've heard of the most interesting man in the world. You've heard of the most interesting man in the world? Well, this is the most interesting man in the galaxy. I got to say that.
I agree with that.
I agree wholeheartedly. This was awesome. And
yes.
He had a plethora of knowledge about not only Star Wars, but just, I mean, he's just clearly a brilliant man.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys are in for a treat.
All right. So insert interview here.
Yep, here we go. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Foster.
Good morning,
Mr. Foster.
Okay, that's enough. Good. That's good. Plenty of good morning. How you doing?
We're doing great.
How you guys doing?
All right. I can't see you, but I bet you can see me and the cat.
I can see the cat.
My name is Jameson Stout. With me is Rob Luther.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. How you doing, Rob?
Oh, doing great. Still recovering from Christmas, but other than that, all right.
Yes, we all are.
And the gentleman on the other side of me here is Landon Long.
Hey, good morning.
Top of the morning to you.
It's a lot earlier over there than it is over here.
Hey, you should be. Well, you guys are in.
We're all Eastern. We're all Eastern Standard Time.
Oh, that's not the last one of these I did was in London, and everybody was going crazy with the time difference. So.
Oh, I bet.
Oh man,
3 hours, nothing.
No, it's cake. Well, we're really excited to have you talking with us for our podcast. I'm not going to lie, we're kind of dorking out a little bit. This is our first interview, and we're thrilled that you were willing to join us.
I'll try to be coherent.
Well, if it's like us, it's just a matter of how much coffee you've had.
Yes, that's true.
Don't do that in the morning, but everybody has something, I guess. I have a cat.
I wish I didn't have a cat.
Yeah, yours wakes you up in the middle of the night, doesn't it?
Oh, she did it again today.
Oh, Lord.
Ours are pretty well behaved. And anyway, what can I do for you guys?
Well, sir, we were going to ask you a few questions specifically focused on your experience with the books.
Right.
In relating to the Star Wars universe. And, of course, all three of us have a few different questions that we might want to ask. And Landon and Rob, please make sure that I don't talk too much. If it's all right, I'll ask the first one. I know that you were the ghostwriter for the original Star Wars.
Yes.
And I was wondering how perhaps you and George Lucas had gotten connected or how that all worked out.
I had done a number of Star Trek logs and a couple of other novelizations prior to the development of the film. And I'd also had my third original novel called Ice Rigger had come out. And apparently, I don't know who, but apparently someone had decided that that was somewhat similar in spirit to this little film that George Lucas was making. And because of that and my experience with novelizations, I might be a suitable person to do a novelization of the film. It was proposed by Valentine Del Rey that I also might be, and I was sent to see Tom Pollock, who at that time was George's lawyer. And we had a nice chat over on Hollywood Boulevard in his offices. And apparently he decided I wasn't a registered axe murderer or something. And that, yes, I might be suitable. So I was sent out to meet with George at Industrial Light and Magic, which at that time was in a rented warehouse in Van Nuys, California, actually 10 minutes from where I grew up. So I knew exactly where it was. Went over there and kind of wandered around, which was fun. Probably should have taken a camera, but, you know, who knew? And George and I had a nice chat. I don't know how he managed to make time for that chat, but he did, and we did. And on that basis, I was approved, and it was a two-book contract. I was asked to do the novelization of the film, of course, and a sequel novel. And that's how Splinter the Mind's Eye came about. And that's how it all happened.
Well, to follow up on that, you know, where was the timeline of this with the whole novelization? Was the film still being made at this point and you were writing the novelization after that? Or how did the timeline work?
This all happened way before the film was finished. I wrote the novelization while it was still in production based on the screenplay they gave me, maybe a dozen of Ralph McQuarrie's pre-production paintings, and so that was pretty much it. I did get to see some rough shots from the film itself of certain sequences. And in fact, I was working on Splinter the Mind's Eye. In fact, Splinter the Mind's Eye, the sequel novel, was finished before Star Wars came out.
Wow, no kidding. I was about to ask about that.
Yeah, so the novelization itself was written well before the film came out.
That's awesome.
Wow. So, I mean, you know, going with that in mind, you know, that the film's still in production, as you're writing this, did you know, oh, man, when this film comes out, this is going to be a hit?
Nobody knew.
Wow.
Nobody. George didn't know. Gary Kurtz didn't know. Charlie Lippincott didn't. Nobody knew. Nobody ever knows. That's the standard line in Hollywood. If you read William Goldman's book about Hollywood, the man who wrote the screenplay for Butch Cassidy and The Princess Bride, wrote a very nice, slim book about working in Hollywood, and he said the key to understanding Hollywood is nobody knows anything.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, as far as the film being a success or not, you know, Splinter was written. The only restriction that was put on me by George in writing Splinter was that it had to be something that could be filmed on a low budget. The idea being that if Star Wars itself was not a huge success but not a complete flop, he could make some kind of a second film reusing as many of the props and backgrounds and costumes as possible from the first film. That's why Splinter is set on a fog-shrouded planet. That's why the first chapter, which consisted almost entirely of a fairly elaborate space battle, which is what forces Luke and Leia down on this planet Mimban, was cut. That was one of only two things that George asked me to take out of the book. I can't remember what the second one was. That's lost in the mists of history, but it was a much smaller thing. So it was an interesting way to approach an original novel. Oh, also, of course, I couldn't use the character of Han Solo because at that point in time, Harrison Ford hadn't signed on for any more sequels or use of his likeness or anything else. So that's why Han Solo isn't in the book. And, of course, Han Solo not being in the book, Chewbacca's not in the book. That's why it focuses almost entirely on Luke and Leia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. And it had a fairly elaborate fight scene, Darth Vader and Luke, which was an impressive imagining by you. Did you use some of Ralph McQuarrie's sketches or anything like that to kind of envision that?
There's one very famous early pre-production painting by Ralph McQuarrie, which shows Luke fighting Darth Vader.
Right.
it may be the most iconic early painting that he did. It's very dynamic, and I had that certainly in the back of my mind when I was choreographing that fight. The idea, of course, of having Luke go down and Leia pick up the saber was something that I thought about. That's not obviously in the film, and again, I had free rein. There is no canon at this point in time. The film hasn't even come out, so I had a lot of freedom, and presumably it was all okay at that point in time because George read it and Charlie read it, and they approved what I had written. Just another direction things could have taken, but it's always interesting to look at Splinter and see certain things that came out of Splinter that were kind of repurposed later on in other films.
Yeah.
Right, like the first one I think about is Darth Vader's hand being cut off. Spoilers.
That's one that's spoilers, yeah. That's one that's always, of course, Leia being, you know, sufficiently Force-sensitive / powerful to be able to use a lightsaber and fight Vader. All of these things kind of popped up, you know, later on. And that's fine. That was part of my job, not to create things that could be repurposed later, but it was work for hire, and the fact that they might have been used as inspiration for certain things later, that's just very flattering, and I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah,
I read in an interview where I think it was maybe Return of the Jedi, where I think you were surprised that they had taken the route where Luke and Leia were actually brother and sister. Is that true?
Well, it surprised everybody. Of course I was surprised. Everybody was surprised. Luke, I am your father. You know, everybody was surprised. But that's what you try to do when you're making sequels. You try to surprise people. The problem with doing a sequel, the biggest problem with doing a sequel, is that if you use the same characters in the same world, 50% of your material is already known to your viewer or your reader.
That's true.
Yeah.
You have to come up with something new. How that happened, you'd have to ask George. You know, he was sitting there and developing the storyline, and he said, well, what can we do here? What can we do here? And those are things that he did.
Yeah. Landon, do you have one?
Oh, well, we kind of already touched on this, but I was just going to ask, you know, while you were writing the stories, were there anything, you know, character histories that were off limits, you know, where they were like, well, we might explore this in a film, so don't go into too much detail about it. Was there anything like that?
No, there was absolutely nothing.
Wow.
Nothing had been developed. Nothing had worked out at that time, as far as I know. At least nothing that I had been – I was not let in on anything if there was anything.
Right.
The thing to remember is that everybody involved with the film at that time was going crazy trying to make a film. And they had no time – nobody's sitting around at that point in time exploring, you know, episode 3, shall
right.
we say.
Right.
It's not like you're George Martin and you're sitting around and saying, well, I'm going to do 12 volumes in this series, and this is what I hopefully can put in Volume 8 and Volume 9, or Robert Heinlein with his Future History series.
Robert Jordan with his
exactly
Wheel of Time series.
Right. The film is different. You don't have time for that, and as much as you might like to do something like that, you might have a few things in the back of your mind, yes, or a few things down on paper. But the process of getting the first film made and hoping that it's a success and can justify any kind of sequel is so overwhelming that you really can't focus on anything but the project at hand.
Yeah. So I have a question. What was the experience like in contrast when you wrote, say, The Approaching Storm or even the Force Awakens novelization? Because clearly there was a little bit more of an outline for a canon and restrictions that would have probably been applied.
Well, when I came back to Star Wars with The Approaching Storm, Del Rey had really been after me for years to do things like, to do sequel books of expanded, what we now call the expanded universe. And I had other things I wanted to write, and I really wasn't interested in doing a novel on, you know, Chewbacca's uncle's life story. Because this thing was exploding all over the place. It took off like nobody's business. It just didn't really interest me. However, when they approached me about doing a novel that would actually fit in the film timeline, in this case between episode 1 and 2, that really interested me. And then the fact that my principal character, or at least two of them, my principal characters, would be a female Jedi and her Padawan. That really intrigued me, and I thought, oh, I could do some interesting things here. So that's how I came to do the approach in Storm. However, after I outlined everything, and remember, there was no outline for Splinter the Mind's Eye. It was just go write a sequel book. You can do this. You can't do that. At that point, there was, by that time, a essentially Star Wars story group. And I had to go up to the ranch and sit with people. And things were discussed in great detail. And I'm not used to working that way. Even on novelizations, I'm usually left alone to do my work. It's very different from the filmmaking process, which is much more collaborative. And I did it, and some things I agreed with and some things I didn't, but I'm proud of the result, the Approaching Storm. And then, of course, when the novelization, when I was asked to do the novelization of The Force Awakens, I had some idea of what to expect based on my work with The Approaching Storm. So I was prepared for multiple commentary and criticism from multiple sources. And again, some of the things I agreed with, some of the things I didn't agree with. There were a lot of things they asked me to take out, which I cannot talk about. I will one day. And there were certain things that I did that I was allowed to leave in, including the thing that I most wanted to leave in, which I was sure they would have me take out.
What was that? I've read it. I'm curious what that was.
Well, that was trying to make the Starkiller weapon, Starkiller base, somewhat conform to the laws of physics as we know them. Now, Star Wars is not exactly what you would call hard science fiction. It's not Stephen Baxter and Greg Bear, and it's not even what passes for hard science fiction with what I write. And even in a galaxy far, far away, you presumably have the same laws of physics, and you can ignore them to a certain extent. And when I could fix them, and there were places in the book where I was not allowed to change things, so be it. But I was sure they would have me take that out. And the Starkiller base, as written in the book version of The Force Awakens, conforms to known physics and known astrophysics insofar as I was able to research them. The thing about it is that the physics involved are so esoteric that there's probably a dozen people on the planet who really understand what's going on. So my theory is that the stuff was so complicated and so close to what's called handwavium, or WU, the short version, that they just left it alone. And I'm really pleased about that, because I would be perfectly confident going up to, say, Neil deGrasse Tyson and discussing the physics with him, knowing that the physics are based in reality, and there's nothing in there that you can point at and say, well, that's just stupid.
Right.
I was sure they'd have me take that out, but that they let me leave in. So you win some, you lose some. You try as best you can, and in that case, that was a win.
That's fascinating.
That's the small victories that you hope for when you're doing a novelization. In the old days, nobody questioned hardly anything I did. I did a lot of novelizations where I was able to do stuff like that, and the studio didn't care. Sitting here was like, it's a spinoff, it's an ancillary right, it's not a big deal. If he wants to do this, that's fine, as long as the book turns out to be a readable, good novel. But that's all changed, particularly with. Yes, I agree, Mr. Stubbs. Cat comment. Particularly with films that studios hope will lead to sequels and become a franchise. If it's a one-shot, you have a lot more freedom. But if it's something that's going to become a franchise, studios understandably want to exercise more control over.
Right.
Well, speaking of the old days, okay, so you're done with the first novelization of Star Wars. The film comes out. You're in the process of writing Splinter at this point. Were you in the theaters? Did you actually see this in theaters and think, holy cow, what has this turned into? What was your original thought of the movie?
We saw the film at a cast and crew screening before the film came out.
Oh, wow.
Oh, well, cool.
Lucasfilm had rented the theater on Hollywood Boulevard. It might have been the old Egyptian before it was fixed back up. And it had curtains open when the film came up.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
That was pretty cool. So we're going back to the Jurassic here. And we were living in California at that time in Big Bear Lake. And we got the invitation, and I said, well, of course, we have to go see this. And I went down there, and I didn't know many people. Writing is a solitary profession. And I wasn't involved with very many of the people, except for George and Gary Kurtz and Charlie Lippincott. And we went in, and I'll tell you the whole story real quick. My wife, Joanne, went down to get us some nice seats. We got there fairly early, and I was chatting with Gary Kurtz in the back and just trying to make conversation, because I only knew Gary casually. And I said, you know what would be cool, because I'm a big animation fan, what would be cool would be to show, if you showed Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century before the film came up. And Gary kind of nodded, and we went on with the conversation. Then I went and sat down next to my wife, and she kind of nudges me and says, look behind you. And I said, what? And she says, look behind you. So I turn around, and here's this scruffy-looking guy. Looks like he wandered in off Hollywood Boulevard after an all-night session with some recreational pharmaceuticals. And I turned back to her, and I said, yeah, so? And she said, don't you know who that is? I said, no. She said, that's Alice Cooper.
Wow.
I was raised on classical music. I didn't get into rock music until I met my wife, who introduced me to everything. And I said, who's Alice Cooper? So she proceeded to explain it to me, and she said, say something to him. And I said, I don't know the guy. What am I going to say to him? You talk to him if you want to talk to him. No, I can't. You say something to him. So I'm thinking, what do I say to this guy, sir? So I turned around and said, you know what would be really cool would be if they showed Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century before the film came up. And Cooper goes, oh, you like old Warner Brothers cartoons too. So we
so we got it.
That's awesome.
So we spent 10 minutes talking about Chuck Jones and Bob Clampett and Warner Brothers cartoons. And then the lights go down, the curtains part, and what do you think comes up on the screen? Not Star Wars. Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century.
So what? Gary,
yep. That's fantastic.
Gary sandbagged me pretty good. The idea being was all the people in the audience, the first time they've seen, they're all involved with the film, most of, you know, and this first time they've seen the completed, finished film. And this was Gary and George's way of breaking the ice and the tension for people who had spent a long time working on the film. Then we saw the film. Then we walked out of the theater. I knew immediately that I didn't have the money to buy any stock. Because I knew it was going to be a huge hit. How huge? Nobody knew. But I knew it was going to be a successful film. You could tell that right away. And my wife jabs me in the ribs. And I go, look at her, and I go, what'd you do that for? She said, you spent 10 minutes talking to Alice Cooper, and all you could talk about was a bunch of old cartoons. So as far as I know, that's the only Alice Cooper Star Wars connection that I've got, and that's how we first saw Star Wars. I then went subsequently, when the film was released, I went to the very first commercial showing. I believe it was 10 o'clock in the morning at Grauman's Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, and I sat in the back of the theater to watch the audience as much as the film. And the audience went berserk.
Wow.
I had never, even though I was a student of film and had seen a lot of films, I thought, at that point in my life, I'd never seen an audience go berserk. I had never seen an audience applaud and cheer in theater. And that, of course, happened after the initial flyover. And from then on, I thought, I've really got to get some money together to buy some stock around here. And we never did.
Wow.
That's quite a story.
Who knows? Maybe Alice Cooper will write a Star Wars novel one of these days. Expanded universe.
Maybe a song.
Alice writes, but he writes other things.
Right.
He has his own expanded universe, I think.
Yes, I think so too. So I have a couple questions about The Approaching Storm, if you don't mind.
Nope.
I reread it recently because I've enjoyed it very much. And one of the questions I had was when Anakin, Obi-Wan, Luminara, and Barriss meet the Yawa clan, one of the nomadic clans in the novel, they have to do this cultural presentation What inspired that particular exchange? Was it perhaps some of your travel experiences?
It was definitely travel experiences. And I've been places where I've actually seen things like that in an environment like that. And of course, as a writer, that's very helpful to actually have experienced something that you're going to adapt in your writing. But I was also prodded to do that by the thought that these are very talented people, the Jedi, and they have to be capable of doing certain things besides kendo exercises and sitting around meditating. I thought, well, if you're a Jedi and you have certain physical and certain mental talents, how else could you translate them into physical action in a way that doesn't involve cutting somebody's arm off, let's say? And I thought that dance would be one way to do that. And it's the sort of thing that Cirque du Soleil might do, for example, or that you might see in a Chinese cultural presentation, only with lightsabers.
Right.
This is how you ingratiate yourself into a local people without taking out a gun and, you know, blowing the top of a tree off. There's better ways to do it. And I thought that was also the sort of approach that a Jedi might take.
My profession is I'm a band director. So having that background, the artistic side of it is something I feel I really connected to, particularly the song that Anakin sang and also the story that Obi-Wan told. And I was wondering if you had a particular story in mind as you were describing Obi-Wan telling it, or if, like, did you have an actual plot or something like that kind of pictured, even though you never explained it?
No, it was just something I developed for the book, but I also like the idea of Obi-Wan being able to tell stories.
Yeah.
We just see him in the early films particularly. There's just a lot of short sentences. And this was an opportunity, which you have in a novel because you have a lot more time than you do in this film, to have him sit down and actually be Obi-Wan for a little while instead of just, you know, the wise old sage at the carnival that you put the quarter in and get your fortune.
That's true. Thank you. All right, guys, go ahead.
So going back to the Jedi and the cultural thing, do you prefer writing more for, like, Force and Jedi-based characters, or do you like just the normal regular people on Star Wars? We've talked about those folks a lot in here and how we enjoy, you know, stories with just the quote-unquote regular folks in the universe.
I like both. I mean, I like them all equally. I've met famous, powerful people, and I enjoy writing those kinds of characters, and I've met a lot of non-famous, non-powerful people, and I enjoy writing those as well. So they're all grist for the mill, as it were. I can't make a distinction between them. A good example of that in current film would be All the Money in the World. And you could ask that question to the screenwriters of that. That, of course, is the story of the kidnapping of John Paul Getty's grandson. Mm-hmm. And there's a great variety. I haven't seen the film, but I've read a fair amount about it. There's a great variety of personality types in that film. And I'm sure the screenwriter, if you asked him that question, would have a similar reaction. It was just as much fun writing about it was just as interesting, I should say, writing about the grandson, the mother of the grandson, and the richest man in the world as anything else. They're all characters.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to know what your take is on what's going on right here and right now with Star Wars. Have you gotten to see The Last Jedi by any chance?
I have not seen the film yet.
Fans say it's quite polarizing. Certainly is, at least from what we've seen. And I was just, you know, kind of wanted to get your take on maybe Rogue One or The Force Awakens. Do you like the direction that Disney's taken everything?
Well, I love The Force Awakens. That's, you know, people look at that and say, well, it's a retread of this, and they redid that. And they don't realize how difficult it was to do that.
Yes.
When you have literally tens of millions of people sitting around for years waiting for this film, not wanting to be disappointed. It's kind of like a friend of mine, a fellow writer whose grandfather handed him $1 million on his 21st birthday. This was decades ago, and said, as I was told the story, here's $1 million, don't screw it up. It's kind of the same situation that J.J. Abrams was in. It's like, I'd like to do this and I'd like to do that, but I have to be careful because the expectations for this are so high. And some people were disappointed, and more people were pleased than were disappointed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things were set up for the next two films. And I have read a fair number of the comments in various places online. And to say that the opinion is polarizing is kind of like saying that, you know, the sun could go nova one day and maybe it will tomorrow. but I reserve judgment until I see the film. I can't really comment until I see the film. So right. I've read what other people have said about it besides the fan comments. One thing that's very interesting about it is this film appears to have a greater divergence of opinion between the fan reviews and the so-called professional critics reviews than maybe any film in history.
Right, yeah. And
that in itself is quite striking.
Well, you know, this is just me personally, and I think we all kind of share this same view on it. It's just exciting to see Star Wars again in the theaters, and for one, I love the old stuff, of course, and I love the old characters, but, you know, I want to see something new, and I want to see something fresh, and these new characters definitely embody that. And I think a lot of folks just want a mirror of what the original trilogy was, and for me, I'm all about, you know, trying something new, trying something a little risky and different. And with that, you're going to get the scrutiny and you're going to get the criticism from the fans. But I'm just happy to see Star Wars in theaters again.
Well, we were going to see Star Wars in theaters again if it was made by three fans in Poughkeepsie.
That's true. That is true.
It was definitely going to be. There will continue to be Star Wars films regardless of what direction the bulk of the critical reaction takes, as long as you have nine-figure box office totals.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
That's what matters at this point in time to the people who own Star Wars. But again, there are things I'd like to say based on what I've read, but that's not really a fair way of doing it. I need to go see it in the theater, and I will do so, and then I will, if anybody asks, venture an opinion. I will say, well, no, I'm not going to talk about it. I can't talk about it until I see the film.
Well, hey, I'll tell you what, though. When you see it, come back on our show. We'd love to hear it.
Yeah. Give me a holler in a couple of months when, you know, things have died down a little bit.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Everybody's had a chance to reflect, and I've actually had a chance to see the picture, and I'll be happy, you know, I'll be happy to do a whole shoot. Whatever you want, I'm always happy to talk. You probably gathered that by now.
Well, that's great. So are we.
We're really enjoying this. I'm going to take you back again. I have another question. I noticed when I looked into some information about you that it appeared you had a close friendship with Brian Daley.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. There's a lot of stuff out there. This is a huge surprise, I know, on the web that bears no relationship to reality.
Yes, I've learned that quite a bit.
And makes real fake news, if that's not a contradiction in terms, looks like something that was chiseled by Egyptian craftsmen in the base of the Great Pyramid. It's just, I actually never met, I think I met Brian Daley once. There are a lot of other people I've met, but not, you know, no close relationship with Brian. That probably kills your next question.
Well, it did, but that's okay. I was just going to ask if you had any experience with the radio dramas.
No.
No, okay.
None whatsoever. I hear they were very good. I'm very pleased with the comic version that Dark Horse did of Splinter, which was really nicely done, adapted for the comic book format. And I have all of those issues tucked away somewhere. It's always nice to see your writing illustrated, whether it's illustrated in comic form, graphic novel form, or illustrated in film, or done as a radio drama. That's always flattering, and you hope that they don't change things around to where it says, shall we say, it contradicts the internal logic, which is a problem with a lot of films, particularly science fiction.
Yeah, speaking of the Dark Horse comics, did anyone consult you about it, or was it just one of those things that you happened to see after the fact?
I saw it after the fact. Star Wars was not my property. It was just something I worked on, like a lot of other people, worked with like a lot of other people. But they were very kindly sent me copies as they came out.
Oh, wow.
And apparently, I think from what I've heard or what I've been told, the fans were very happy with the graphic adaptation as well.
No, that's great.
You mentioned that you might not have a whole lot of contact with the actual company of Star Wars. What about other Expanded Universe authors? Did you have any contact with any of them?
No, we meet each other at conventions. I haven't been able to travel for a while. But when I did get to conventions, and I do get to at least one per year, I do meet people who, you know, work in the Expanded Universe, like Kevin Anderson and Michael Kogi and other people, and we chat briefly, but we're actually much more interested in talking about other things.
I can understand that.
It's like if, you know, three plumbers get together, they don't talk plumbing.
No.
Landon and Rob?
The only other one I wanted to ask you about, and of course, I'm a new fan of yours. I've read your Star Wars work, but I have not read your Commonwealth series and your Damn Trilogy and your Spellsinger series. I'm really looking forward to reading them, especially now that I've talked to you and gotten to know you a little bit better. But I just wanted to ask, my last question for you was, you know, what does Star Wars mean to you personally after all these years?
That's actually a very good question that people don't ask generally. They're so involved with the minutiae that sometimes the big stuff doesn't get asked. It was important to me to be able to do something like that because I love film. And even though a novelization is only a peripheral involvement, what it basically does is it lets me make my own director's cut, depending on how much they leave me alone to do it. And the person who's writing something like the novelization of Star Wars or Alien or anything else is I'm one half professional writer and I'm one half the fan, 14-year-old fan, sitting in the back of the theater with his friends, loudly criticizing the lousy special effects on the screen. And you put those two together and you get my novelizations for what it's worth. So Star Wars in particular was the first real important novelization I did, but of course I wasn't allowed to admit to having done it for many years because it was in the contract that George's name would be on the cover of the book, which it still is, and I was fine with that. It's not my universe. It's not my story. It's his. And I was fine with that. The only problem was that insofar as a few people could recognize something that could be called my style, they would come up to me at conventions, back when I went to more conventions, and say, you know, this reads an awful lot like your stuff. And you've done some of these before. Are you sure you didn't ghostwrite this? And I would look them in the eye and say, nope, had nothing to do with it. And when you're doing that with friends, it's tough.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What happened was time went by and the first real book on George's work came out called Skywalking, The Life and Times of George Lucas by Dale Pollack. And in that book, it had inadvertently been mentioned that I did the novelization. So at that point, this was years after the film had come out. It seemed kind of, you know, silly to continue having to deny it. So my agency asked for a release from Lucasfilm, which was very, very nicely granted. And from that point on, I could be honest about it. And of course, George subsequently has, you know, admitted to it too. At that time, it was important that I be in the background as a ghostwriter. Subsequently, after multiple films and Star Wars becoming a human phenomenon, it wasn't as important anymore. But I have no regrets about it or no problems with it, and I would do it again if I was asked.
No, that was going to be one of my questions, is if you anticipated or would be willing to do another Star Wars project in the future.
Well, that depends on what I think of the current film and what the nature of the project is. And I've always wanted to do... I have a master's in screenwriting from UCLA, and I always wanted to do screenplays. Wow. But I've done screenplays, they just haven't been produced. Some have come close, I've been paid for them. But it's very difficult to do unless you live in Los Angeles and can circulate among the people who are responsible for getting films made. A lot of these decisions, since people always ask, how do these films get made, are based on personal contact and personal interaction. And I'm just not in that loop. And for better or worse, I'm a very straightforward, honest person, particularly where my work is concerned and where criticism is concerned. I've written criticism also. And it would be very difficult for me to look somebody in the eye and say, after viewing the film premiere, that's, you know, a terrific film, you're going to make a lot of money, it's absolutely wonderful. I just don't think I could do that if the film was bad.
Right.
And for better or worse, that's the way sometimes you have to be to make a success of yourself there. I just can't do that. And so I stay away from it. Maybe that's one reason why I don't get film projects made. If I had stayed in Los Angeles instead of moving not long after Star Wars came out, Star Trek was responsible for that, not Star Wars, I probably would do more work in film and fewer novels. But I'm very happy writing books. Nobody bothers me. You know, this, you have to change this character from, you know, a 6-foot black man to a 3-foot lesbian dwarf. Nobody says, you know, we have to have rockets on our international, in our intergalactic spaceship. And I can do whatever I want. I have an unlimited budget. I have plenty of time. I get to go into much more depth in characters' motivations and what they're thinking. It's a wonderful thing to be able to write novels. And film is wonderful too, but it's a completely different medium. I'm just not in a position to do it right now.
Well, Mr. Foster, you know, that kind of brought up something I was hoping to ask. I love to write. I do it for fun. Do you have any advice for any writers out there? Anything that, you know, professional and just amateur writers could benefit from?
Believe it or not, I've been asked this question before.
I have a gut feeling you have.
No, I've taught seminars and such, and the question always comes up, and you could go on and on about it. But basically, the most important thing that I've discovered over nearly half a century of doing this is you need to sit, if you're going to write seriously, you need to do something every day. That's the first thing. It might be 2 paragraphs, but you sit there and you write something, and you'd be surprised once you start getting words down. You begin to get a flow, and you tell yourself, well, I've done 2 paragraphs, I'll do a page. And then it becomes, I've done a page, let's try to do 2 pages. And if you do 1 page a day, at the end of the year, you've got a 365-page novel.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's true.
I could, might be bad, but you've actually done it. The second thing is, don't worry so much about ideas. People sit around and think, oh, I've got this great idea. Ideas are easy. It's page 1 is easy, and page 365 is easy. It's the 363 pages in between that are difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The next thing is, don't worry about getting from page 6 to page 7. If you get stuck, and this is what kills a lot of people, skip page 7, go to page 8. You can always come back to page 7. It's more important to move the story along than to get, say, page 7 perfect. You know, write something in there, even if it's just a placeholder, and you look at it and say, oh, that's terrible, it doesn't make any sense, it doesn't really work with the character. At least you've gotten page 7 down. Now you go on to page 8, which hopefully will be easier. People get hung up on making everything perfect at the beginning. And this applies to not short stories and screenplays and anything that you're writing. You can always go back and revise. You can always go back and fill in. But people will do a chapter or two, and they'll come to a dead end, and they'll get stuck there, and then they'll give up.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm guilty of that. Yep.
So those are the basics.
Just out of curiosity, do you have a particular process for how you approach? Is it perhaps different writing a novelization than perhaps writing one that you have complete freedom over? What is your writing process for each of those?
I approach a novelization the same way I do a novel, with all of the things that I just mentioned in mind. But I do have one thing that's different. I know that I have so many pages of screenplay to adapt. Let's say it's a 2-hour movie. The general loose rule of thumb is you get 1 minute of movie for every page of screenplay. That's a very rough rule of thumb, but it generally works. So if I have a 120-page screenplay, I know how many words I generally get per page. And if I'm going to have a 360-page novel, which would probably be around 85,000 words, which is a good length, I know it's going to be between 80 and 90,000. I know that I need to get 3 pages of prose for every page of screenplay.
Wow.
So I might get to page say, page two of the screenplay and have 7 pages of prose written, I'm ahead. Then I think, well, I only need to get 2 pages of prose out of the next page of screenplay. And conversely, if I get to page two and I only have 3 pages written, I'm behind and I need to make that up somewhere. So even though I'm expanding and developing characters and expanding on the action and the backgrounds, as I'm writing a novelization, I know that I need to get so many pages of prose out of so many pages of screenplay, and that if I let myself fall behind in that page count, or word count really, I'm going to be in trouble by the time I get to, say, page 20 of the screenplay. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's just like writing, it's a collaboration, it's just like writing a novel. I try to preserve the original writer or writer's style, if you will, as much as possible. I don't contradict directly anything that happens in the movie, because you can't do that, because fans will read the book and say, this contradicts everything this I saw in the film. But in between those places, in the little gaps in there, where I'm allowed to fill in, that's where I try to expand on characterization. That's where I try to fill in on descriptions of action and backgrounds. And that's where I try to put in my own little fanish corrections, if you will.
Yeah. Wow. I have just some personal questions, because I know, as you mentioned, talking about work is not always the most enjoyable thing. You mentioned that you enjoyed traveling. Where is perhaps your favorite place to have traveled or that you would like to go to?
Different places offer different things, obviously. And if you're looking for culture, you go someplace different than from, say, Central Africa. If you're looking for adventure, you don't go to London, let's say, unless you want to walk around certain parts of the city at 3 o'clock in the morning. But that's it's true of any big city on the planet. But for culture, I'd have to say my favorite places are London and Prague. Okay. Prague is a wonderful city because it wasn't bombed in World War I or World War II. That's why they shot Amadeus there instead of in Vienna.
Hmm. Yeah.
And you can start in the center of Prague at about the 13th century, if I remember correctly, and walk through the centuries as you walk towards the suburbs. And every building, every other building is an architectural marvel. It's just a wonderful city. London, of course, is London. For adventure and wildlife, I'd have to say Papua New Guinea.
Okay.
New Guinea, really. New Guinea is parts of New Guinea, the central highlands of New Guinea are the last place on Earth where humans had contact with the outside world, and that was in the early 1930s. Nobody thought anybody lived in the center of New Guinea prior to that. They thought it was just empty jungle, and there were like 1 million subsistence farmers living up there. That's a whole other story, but you can go to parts of New Guinea and still find very old people, and sometimes not so very old people, who will admit to consuming their neighbors.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
The government says that doesn't exist because they consider it bad for – it's bad PR for tourism. But the reality of it is something else. It is a remarkable, exciting, beautiful country, has some of the best diving in the world. And if you want to see large animals, you go to Southern Africa or Central Africa if you can get around in Central Africa. That's not an easy place to get around or safe, but people say, well – how can you go to some place like Central Africa? It's so dangerous and it's full of poachers and militias. And I said, if you really want to do something dangerous, go walk around downtown Washington, D.C. at 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
No kidding.
So the problem is that on the news, you only see bad things. If they have 30 seconds to devote to, say, Zambia, it's going to be 30 seconds of bad news about Zambia. And that's just the way people get their news these days, unless you spend more time on the web and look at external sources, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So those are just some of my favorite places. As far as places I'd still like to go, I've been a lot of places, but there's always some place I haven't been. I haven't been to mainland China yet. Co-writer and I, Joel Burke, actually have a screenplay that's under development, science fiction, that's all Chinese-based.
Oh, wow.
Hopefully for production in China. I'd like to go to Siberia. I had a professor at Far Eastern University there invite me many, many years ago to come look for tigers, and unfortunately I couldn't take him up on that offer at that time. There's still some places in Western Africa I haven't been. I haven't been to Paris yet. I mean, it's not all, you know, hacking through the woods with a machete and getting eaten alive by bugs. There's lots of places I haven't been yet, and I still have some time. It's just I haven't been able to travel for a few years, but for various considerations. But hopefully that will change, and I'll jump on a plane and head somewhere again. I'm stuck on this one planet, and I've devoted a lot of my life to seeing as much of it as I possibly can because it's all I've got, unless Elon Musk starts selling tickets. The only problem with that is Mars looks just like Yuma. And I can always drive down there and sort of half close my eyes and, you know, imagine I'm there. Or there's a place in Namibia where I have been called Sisisvlei, which really does look like Mars and has been in a few movies.
Wow.
You can always go there and pretend you're on Mars, and the air there is as clear as it would be on Mars. Actually, it's a remarkable place. It's an interesting planet we've got. We're screwing it up at an accelerated rate, unfortunately. And there's too many people and too few places, but it's still an interesting place to go puttering around.
Mm. Yes, it is. Well, I saw that in 2018 with Del Rey, you have a new novel coming out. I believe it's called Reliquary.
Relic is the title now. It was originally called. The title now is Relic. It'll be out in August.
Okay. Would you like to talk about that or any other projects you might have coming up?
Well, Relic is about it's not a Commonwealth novel. It's not a Pip and Flinks novel. It's a standalone. I got to thinking one day, as you do when you're trying to think of something for a book, about writing something about the last human being in the universe. Excuse me. I've been watching too many science fiction movies. The last human being in the galaxy, although I suppose human qualifies as well. And what would it be like? He's being taken care of by aliens, and because there are no other humans, and how would you react? You know, how would you handle that? Could you survive? Would you just go somewhere and quietly shoot yourself? Would you be excited by the prospect? So that's what Relic is about. And as I said, that will be out in August. Also, Del Rey will be doing, at least as an electronic book, a collection of stories about a character of mine named Matt Amos Malone, who is a mountain man who's also been to the Sorbonne in Tibet and an interesting guy. And over the years, there are now 18 stories about this character. It's what you would call Weird Western today. And people have asked if they could find this story or that story. So Del Rey will do the collection. It'll be called The Complete Matt Amos Malone. And I don't know when that will be out or who'll be doing the hardcover, but that'll be out next year as well.
That's great. Exciting.
Yeah.
And I have a Commonwealth novel, which is finished, but hasn't been submitted yet, called Secretions, and it all takes place on a world that's essentially based on slime.
Oh, cool.
That sounds interesting.
So that's for next year, hopefully, as well.
All right. Guys, do you have any other questions?
I just want to thank you so much for, gosh, just being so generous with your information. And this has been a lot of fun for me as a fan. I'm just really, really thankful and gracious. And I cannot wait to, you know, hear what you think of The Last Jedi. And maybe we can talk about Rogue One day. And just thank you so much for agreeing to talk with us.
It's my pleasure. And believe it or not, other people have asked me my opinion of The Last Jedi. And again, I'm not going to say anything until I see the film.
That sounds good. Well, hey, to be continued.
Yes, then I'm sure I'll have plenty to say.
Well, I know I certainly want to thank you. This has been a true pleasure and an absolute joy. I've enjoyed all the books, at least in the Star Wars universe, that you've written, and I've certainly been very interested in digging into the material that you've written outside of the Star Wars universe, and it's just fascinating to actually get the opportunity to speak with the actual writer in this particular context. That's not something I would have ever pictured myself being able to do even 5 years ago. So thank you so much for doing this with us.
You're most welcome, guys.
Yeah, I want to thank you as well. I mean, I really enjoyed the travel stories too. You know, that's one thing I'm really interested in is traveling and seeing the world and, you know, with a kid and a job, that's kind of hard sometimes. But I really enjoyed those travel stories. Really enjoyed. I'm still reading the novelization of The Force Awakens, and just really enjoying the more, I guess, the way the characters are thinking, their motivations, and the way they're thinking as opposed to the screen. Really enjoying that. And again, thank you so much for being on.
If you're curious, people were after me for years to write a travel book.
Well, there you go. I would buy it.
Yeah, me too.
I would too.
Well, I didn't want to do, you know, how can I do this? I didn't want to do, here we are today on the Spanish Steps, and over here is the famous statue by Michelangelo, and blah, 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 because that's been done over and over. And then it occurred to me one day, well, everybody likes stories about animals. And I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of interesting encounters with some interesting animals. So there is a book from Open Road Media called Predators I Have Known, which is not about Hollywood. And it's basically, it's travel stories. So if you want to read more, there it is.
Okay, awesome.
Okay, hey, great. Thank you.
Well, good luck, guys, and it was fun talking to you.
Oh, you too.
It was great talking to you.
So much,
yes, you
too. Look forward to talking to you again.
Bye bye.
All right, take care.
Wow.
He's like the most interesting man on the planet.
I was gonna say that. He's that was. You know what he's like? He reminds me of the promo for the Dos Equis guy.
Yes.
That's him.
He is the most interesting man in the world. Oh, man.
Good stuff, man.
That was good.
I don't know how to thank him enough. That was. An awesome
one of the best
interview.
Interviews I've ever been part of.
And he was just so easy to talk to.
He was. He was really, really knowledgeable, too. I feel like I should go buy every book he's ever written now.
I know. And there's so many things. I mean, I would have loved to... when he started to kind of indicate that, you know, talking about work was not the most fun thing, I was like, well, let's go from a personal note here. But
yeah.
I'd love to know, like, what kind of research he does. So for, like, the physics and stuff like that, that was... When
yeah,
he
that was
he
cool.
wanted to make, I wanted to make it real physics. I was like, oh, okay. You know, I know authors do research, but that's just, you know, I've never really considered. Do you sit down with a science book and just teach yourself? Or do you call, hey, you know physics. I went to college with you. Can you answer this question for me or tell me how this would work?
Knowing him, he probably did both.
Probably so. I mean, well, he probably went and got a master's degree in physics first, you know.
That's true. Yes.
And he built his own little mini
Starkiller
Star Destroyer.
Yeah. And I'm impressed the cat stayed on his lap the entire time.
That's a nice cat. I'd like
that was
that
the coolest cat ever.
Beats the crap out of mine. I know that.
That was the coolest cat I believe I've ever seen.
It was a ginger.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I'll tell you what, guys. Sounds like he was open for coming on again.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, we've got the email account set up for any of us to email him at this point. So that'll work out really well.
Yeah.
Find out when he sees the movie and then shoot him a link to the podcast where we talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll try to be in contact with him. That'll be something we can do.
Yeah.
I'm just – that was so much fun.
That was good.
That's energizing right there.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of one of those ones where you're like, wow, I just got to talk to that guy for an hour.
And it was about a solid hour,
yeah,
almost exactly.
Yeah,
which is good. I mean, that's a good amount of time. I didn't
I
didn't want to take him too long. And Landon, you didn't really get a lot of chances to ask questions. I hope.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm sorry, man.
I'm sorry, buddy. We didn't mean to.
That's all right. Shoot, man. I asked what I wanted to ask. He addressed a lot of my questions, like in his follow.
Kind
of yeah, me too.
Like,
I was actually kind of scrambling there.
I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna have to think of something else to ask him because he is just like killing every question I wrote down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. In one question, he answers about five on my sheet, and I'm like, I only have 11 questions. I feel bad for asking about Brian Daly. He shot me down pretty quick there. I don't know.
Well, hey, there you go. You can dispel some rumors that he knows.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can't believe everything you read on the internet.
No, there you go. There's the bumper of our show.
All right. Well, thanks again, and I think I'm going to get off here before my wife gets home because she sent me a text saying she's on her way.
Yep, mine too.
But it was great talking to you, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, man. It was an experience, man.
Totally geeking out. I'm still like I can't believe I did that.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
And I see the little red dot that says recording, file size 43,970-something kilobytes.
Hey, nice.
So That means we actually recorded.
Yes!
Hooray, and my Skype
success.
Didn't knock me off or anything.
I know. This never happens.
You must be living right.
I know.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened, but I'm not going to complain. I'm just going to be very thankful that we made it through. Once again, guys, thanks. And I'll check in with you here in a few days.
Right. Sounds good, man. You guys have a good one.
Yeah. You too. Have a lot of fun.
See you guys. Bye. So long, nerd boys. Wow.
Yeah.
I can say, man, the show's starting to hit its stride. This is pretty cool. I can't think of a better first interview.
Yeah. I can't either. And I'm really hoping this kind of takes off and gets people listening.
Yeah.
You know, just get some listeners.
Oh yeah.
I know we've got a faithful few, and thanks to them that are listening, but I would love to kind of branch out and be like, hey, check out, and you know, we're not a huge name, but
mm-hmm.
we've got some interesting topics we're covering, and it's a lot of fun, and we're just having a good old time.
Yeah.
Talking about Star Wars.
Oh, hey, and Landon?
What?
Stout, should I tell him our Christmas gift to Landon? Or, no, you tell him. You're the guy, you tell him.
But,
it was a mutual endeavor. I realized as I was looking at it, one, of course, I made you an administrator for the page and put you on the listing as one of the co-hosts for the podcast, but I realized, you know, if you look at that picture, it's just our ugly two faces.
Yeah, something's missing.
Something was missing. Uh-oh. So Rob and I both got together, and we've hired BJ to add you in to the Star Wars Ties logo.
Yeah, my third ugly face.
Yeah.
You guys should just Photoshop me in there and like make it look as cheesy and as corny as ever.
That would be
like
great.
This real life photo of you in the background.
It's like me like eating
floating like Starkiller base in the background.
It's like me eating a bowl of cereal like looking up like, huh?
You don't even know you're taking a picture, yeah.
Candid shot, you know. But I don't know when she'll be done, but when she does, we'll of course.
Oh gosh! Thank you.
No problem, man. She said it would be where I think the second ones are her list for the new year, so it'll probably be done by mid January. So here in about 2 weeks or so.
Well, we've talked about the Expanded Universe books, and and I certainly don't want to veer away from that too much. But I realize there's one element of the Star Wars universe storyline that we've never really discussed on this podcast yet.
Oh, what's that?
It's a video game.
Ooh.
I was going to say Slave Leia, but... Hey, I got Battlefront 2 over Christmas. I meant to tell you, they had it on sale Christmas Day for $30.
What?
Is that the... What, did you get it for Xbox or GameCube or...
PS4.
What do you think? Is it good?
You're talking about the new one. Okay.
Yeah, they had it for $30 like the day after Christmas.
See, I've not played any of the newer games. Like the most recent Star Wars game I have.
I could see it being fun online with other people. Like I've just been doing the missions. Like it's kind of cool because it asks you at the first if you want to be more light side bonuses or dark side, and if your team wins, you get more. You know, credits for more weapons and stuff. And you get special heroes. Like, I think Finn is the light side hero that you get, and Phasma is the First Order hero you get.
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's, I'm wanting to play it online, but I don't want to have to pay to do the online service thing. So I'm just playing, like, the campaign and the little missions, the little side missions.
Right.
But it's good so far. It's really good.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I was thinking is maybe we could just kind of step into talking about some of the games, some of our favorites, maybe kind of, I mean, I know that Landon, you and I had a really good time just kind of shooting the breeze on that one Wingnut style
episode
we did a few episodes back, but just have it, the only restriction be video games, and that way if you want to, you know, over the break or on the weekend or something, you just want to play a game for kicks and giggles, you can, and, you know, that's your research for it. You don't have to, it's not a lot of hard work.
Oh, and Landon, I got to pick a bone with you. Or a bone to pick with you.
What's that?
He's got to pick a bone with you. Watch out.
That's never good.
Well, I mean, you are Lando Fett, so, you know, it depends on whether or not you ate the meat on the bone.
Oh,
you know?
Well.
but I'm excited about this one.
Me too, man.
Yes.
And the awesome thing is there's not a lot of us to edit out, so it really won't take that long.
There's a little bit of me. There's a little bit of me, but...
Well, there's a little bit of me with us and ums, but even then, I mean, it's just there's not a lot there of stuff that I want to cut out of it.
Yep.
And he was...
We just let the man talk.
Yeah. Just let him talk, and he didn't use any inappropriate language. I'm going to have to doctor, so this will be a really easy edit. I do have one other request, and it's a little selfish of me to ask this, and I'm sorry, but I was wondering if you might be willing to give us a little bit of a promo that we could put at the beginning of our show. Something along the lines of, this is Alan Dean Foster, and you are listening to Star Wars Ties.
Sure. You ready to record?
It's already recording, sir.
This is Alan Dean Foster, and this is Star Wars Ties.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
That's awesome. We'll make sure to edit that in at the beginning of our show.
Now we're legit.
Yeah.
Nutty Star Wars bar. Can you forget all the creatures in there? And hey, Darth Vader in that black and evil mask. Did he scare you as much as he scared me? Star Wars. Those here in Bar Wars. My seventh winner up here. Star Wars.